I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks. My guest today is John Grisham, who is in Charlotte this week as part of his first book tour in 25 years. He's a struggling writer, and his publisher didn't know whether anyone would show up for an autograph session, but nonetheless, they pressed on. After all, he's only sold around 300 million books in a career that includes dozens of novels, a short story collection, and a children's series. John Grisham's 30th novel, Camino Island, has just been published, and you can expect to see it on the bestseller lists all summer long. In case you've been in a coma these past 30 years, John Grisham's earlier novels include The Firm, A Time to Kill, The Pelican Brief, and Runaway Jury, to name just a few. By the time you hear this interview, John will have likely torn a rotator cuff signing books at Park Road Books on Wednesday afternoon. And with that, John Grisham, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with the new book, of course. You have said that you and your wife were on a long car trip when you started toying with the idea of stolen manuscripts, and Hemingway and Fitzgerald and others came to mind. What convinced you that this was more than a fun conversation and perhaps a book?
Well, it evolved. We were going to the beach, and we usually do a long summer road trip, throw the dog in the back seat and pack some good food, listen to books on tape, listen to podcasts, and we were listening to NPR, and there was a story about some stolen rare books. I can't remember exactly where it was. And so down the road, we started talking about that. We have some rare books. For 25 years, I've collected first editions of Faulkner, Hemingway, Steinbeck, Fitzgerald, and a few others. And so after 25 years, you know, there are quite a few books. I'm not a serious collector, but I know a little bit about the market. So it just sort of evolved. And before I knew it, I thought we were talking about this. Could you write a mystery around a bookstore, a guy who trades in rare books, but also stolen stuff, and nobody knows it, and makes a lot of money doing that. And so it just evolved, but it became a lot of fun. And our original plan was that there are two main characters: Mercer Mann, who is a young female writer who's struggling, and Bruce Cable, who owns the bookstore. So you have two main characters. And I was going to write the sections. We're going to alternate chapters: Bruce and Mercer, mm-hmm. and Bruce and Mercer. And I was going to write the Bruce chapters, and Renee was going to write the female chapters. And that was good for about 200 miles. But by the time we got to the beach, she had ditched the idea of writing anything with me. So the book was all mine.
So you had to just pick it up and go from there.
I did. I actually became captivated by it. And as soon as I got to the laptop, at the beach, and had some time, I started researching manuscripts and stories about stolen books, and really got into it.
Now, you mentioned Mercer Mann, who is your main character. She's a struggling writer when we meet her. She's just lost her teaching job at UNC Chapel Hill because of state budget cuts. And I'm just wondering, wherever did you get the crazy notion that North Carolina's legislature would cut education funding?
Well, everybody's doing it, okay? It's epidemic.
But you also, of course, a lot of people think of you or associate you with Mississippi and Virginia. You went to Mississippi State, mm-hmm. then Ole Miss, and of course you were in the legislature. And a lot of your earlier books were set in Mississippi,
right.
And you've lived in horse country in Virginia for a while, for many years, I should say. But I don't know if many people realize that your wife and your daughter graduated from UNC Chapel Hill. And in 2010, I believe you gave the commencement address at Chapel Hill. So are you an honorary Tar Heel at this point?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have the degree. My daughter graduated in 2008, and we had spent so much time down here in Chapel Hill because she wanted us down here, all the time. My son went to UVA. We live in Charlotte. We didn't see him for 4 years. But our daughter was at Chapel Hill, and she wanted us down for every ball game, every sorority function. And once she graduated, my wife was born in Raleigh, so she's from North Carolina. She grew up in Mississippi, and that's how we met. But Renee said, after 20 years, 25 years, she said, "I'm going back to college to finish my degree, and I'm not going to UVA. I'm going to UNC." Mm-hmm. And her grades were nearly perfect, so she transferred in. And for 2 years, she commuted from Charlottesville to Chapel Hill, graduated in 2010.
Wow.
They asked me to give the commencement speech that year, and I said, only if she will approve, because it's your day, not mine. Mm-hmm. And she said, "I think it'd be pretty cool." And so I did it. And we had a grand time. They asked me to come back the following year. So I've been to three UVA commencement. I got my honorary degree the following year. And what's bad is we have Shay's degree, my daughter, Renee's degree from the baby blue, Carolina blue. And then my honorary degree is twice as big as theirs. I did no work for it, okay?
You didn't have to pay tuition either.
I didn't pay anything for it.
With that in mind, I'm wondering, have you become a Tar Heel fan? Do you follow the basketball team closely? I believe you and Charlie Rose have bantered about that a little bit, right?
Charlie Rose and I bet $100 on every Duke Carolina game. And we're arguing now because I say he owes me $100. Duke won 2 out of 3 last year. And I think he owes me $100 because we won the national title. We're big Tar Heel fans.
Very good. I'm wondering, you've written a baseball novel, you've written a football novel, and given your love of Tar Heel hoops, I'm wondering, do you see a basketball story in your future?
I never know. I've learned not to predict where the stories are going to come from. I wanted to do a baseball novel from day one. Didn't have the story, and in the meantime wrote 2 football novels, and then finally one day had the story for Calico Joe. It became a baseball book, and I played basketball in high school, and you love the sport, so who knows.
Your previous novel, The Whistler, featured a female lead, as does Camino Island. Wondering what differences or challenges do you see writing females as opposed to males, if any?
Well, it's very difficult because, you know, we can't think like women. And my wife reminds me of that all the time. It's a real challenge. I think it's difficult to write from the perspective of the opposite sex. But I'm still trying.
And was that intentional with these past 2 books? How did that come about?
It's always intentional.
You hope,
well,
right?
Listen, 70% of all novels are purchased by women in this country. In the marketplace, you know, 70% of all novels. And so that's a big factor. And 1/3 of all books are purchased at Christmas time, say in the Christmas market. So, you know, you keep those things
right
in mind when you're writing popular fiction for a broad audience year after year, you think about those things.
And did, with The Whistler, for example, did that start to change your audience in any way? And do you think this Camino Island will change your audience?
I don't know if the audience is going to change. Camino may pick up a few other readers. My readers have been very loyal. They'll put up with an occasional sports book or a comic novel like Skipping Christmas or a nonfiction. They'll buy those, okay? But my fans want a legal thriller every year. And for 25 straight years, I've given them one, and that's what they want. And I've got the one ready for October. It's almost finished now. So the legal thriller is done.
So in your mind, this is sort of sneaking one in when you –
Very much so. And my publisher did not know, use the great word sneak. I didn't tell anybody I was writing this. And I finished it right around Christmas time. And the first week in January, just for fun, we sneaked it into Doubleday and dropped it on the desk. They had no idea it was coming. And, you know, it was a big deal.
I was going to say, that's a great late Christmas present for Doubleday, right?
They enjoyed it, yeah.
As you're looking ahead, you mentioned, obviously, you have the book coming out in the fall. Mm-hmm. And then how often do you try and sneak something in? Is it just kind of when the muse strikes?
Sure. If the story can come out of nowhere, you know, whatever, it could be a basketball idea I have. I'm probably going to write a kid's book this fall for the Theo series. I skipped last year, and I've had 6 of those, and I'm beginning to wonder how long I can sustain, you know, a series. I'm thinking about that. So I'm probably going to try to do one every other year, and then maybe another Camino Island book. I don't know.
Because I'm not going to give anything away, but there is the potential for these characters to continue on beyond that. Again, was that intentional at the time?
Yes, some stories lend themselves to sequels. I've only done that a couple of times. Other stories, you know, I kill everybody off and can't come back.
That's more of the Larry McMurtry approach.
Yeah, that's more fun. They're dead. I'm tired of them. They're dead.
As you look back at such a long career, you've got 30 novels, you've done these other works. I know a lot of people, particularly musicians, you hear them say that their songs are like children. They can't pick favorites. But do you have favorites and lesser favorites, so to speak?
Yes. Yes. There's some I look back and think about certain books that I enjoy the stories. I have never – they're not like children. A song you can sing over and over and over and never get tired of it. A book takes a long time to read. I've never gone back and read one of my books. By the time I finish a book – for example, Camino Island is out right now. I finished it in January, and since then I've written the legal thriller for the fall. So, you know, I'm always thinking about the next book, not – I don't go back and – I read Bleachers one time for the audio for the audiobook, and I'll never do that again.
For any book.
For any book, no. It's a very thin book, and I'm not going to do it again.
And is that do you become self-conscious, or is it just that you've moved on?
Well, reading a book for audio is a lot of work, and it takes a certain amount of theatrical, dramatic talent, of which I have none. And, you know, I'm not trained for that. And you read the really good actors who read these books, they can do different voices and keep it all straight. And, you know, I was plowing through it, and I spent 3 days in a sound booth, you know, with a headphones on, and I'm thinking, why am I doing this? For $5,000, you know, pay somebody else.
You're hearing the voice of John Grisham, the best-selling author of Camino Island. He's joining us today on Charlotte Talks, and I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and we're joined today in studio by best-selling author John Grisham. He's in Charlotte as part of his first book tour in 25 years, getting the band back together, and his new book is called Camino Island. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the obvious, which is, what's it like to be out there again on a book tour? Are you already tired of signing autographs and hearing questions, or...?
Not at all. We've had 4 stops already. Today is the 5th one here in Charlotte. And the people are very, very nice. The people are very grateful to stop by and say hello and, you know, meet the author. And it's fun meeting them. And over the years, I've always had this, you know, kind of a nagging, guilty feeling when I would read an article, a magazine piece or a newspaper piece about a great independent bookstore anywhere in the country, and I would have the thought, you know, I should go there. I should go there and say thanks and meet the fans and sign some books and just, you know, support the bookstore. I would have those thoughts, and I was too lazy to go. I never did it. But it is important for best-selling authors to tour, to get out. And you know, that's what I'm doing. I'm having a good time.
So by the time you hear this on the radio, he will have been at Park Road Books, and hopefully you were there to get an autograph and listen to him read a little bit. Last year in the Washington Post, one of their critics, Patrick Anderson, described your novels like this. Quote, "I can't think of another major American novelist since Sinclair Lewis who has so effectively targeted social and political ills in our society." End quote. How do you balance entertainment with enlightenment and not overdo it with the spinach, so to speak?
Tough question. It's you can't overdo the issues because you sort of get political and you don't want to impose your politics on your readers because it's not always the same. The best books I write are where I take an issue, whatever it is, and can weave a suspenseful story around it. And a lot of them are suspenseful. When you're dealing with wrongful convictions and death penalties and guys on death row and a lot of the issues I write about from the legal point of view, they can be suspenseful stories. I'll write a few of those and run out of issues or whatever, and then my wife will say, okay, get off your soapbox and just write us a good, entertaining novel. And that's what I do with Camino Island. It's just pure fun. It's a beach book.
Yeah, it really is. And the thing that strikes me about Camino Island is it's a beach book in every sense. Obviously, it takes place at the beach,
right.
But it's also about books. And it's also a love letter to bookstores and readers and writers. And you drop names of, I assume, a lot of books that you love by a wide range of authors.
Yeah, I mentioned a lot of first editions by a lot of authors. And I had to do the research. It wasn't difficult, but I talked to some rare book dealers to make sure that I had the values right, you know, to what's it worth? How much is this book going to be worth? And that was a lot of fun. Some of the books I own, I do not own Catcher in the Rye. I mentioned that twice.
Yes, you do.
It's very rare to find a copy of Catcher in the Rye signed by J.D. Salinger. And if you find one in good condition, it's probably going to be close to $100,000.
Wow.
I mean, these things have some value. And they're very hard to find. But Bruce, in the story, had two or three of them.
Yes.
And he was very proud of them, and they weren't for sale. They were in his basement where he kept them protected. So he had some money invested in his rare books. It makes it all the more fun. You think this is a small-town book dealer. How can he have the cash to pay for the Fitzgerald manuscripts? I mean, nobody's got that kind of money from the thieves.
Right.
Well, you know, I'm not going to tell you what happens.
And I'm not either, but I will say you're listening, obviously, to the voice of John Grisham, and he just mentioned F. Scott Fitzgerald. This book centers around the theft of all 5 manuscripts of F. Scott F. Scott Fitzgerald's novels from the Princeton University collection. And the thieves then go on the black market, and then the fun really begins.
That's the first chapter, is the heist that they pull off. They pull the perfect crime. They get away with it. They think they do. And then the things start to fall apart almost immediately. And there's only one of them. It's a team of five. And only one of them is kind of left standing. And he makes a quick exit out of the country. And once the theft is over, the whole world of rare books and stolen rare books and manuscripts and artifacts just sort of goes on alert, waiting for the first sign from somebody somewhere that the books are for sale.
Where is it?
Where is it? And how much? And how much? You know, is it going to be a ransom call back to Princeton? Is it going to be a dealer? And that's a whole setup.
And I should mention, while there are a couple of lawyers, they're very, very minor players. So this is all but lawyerless John Grisham, if that's possible.
I tried my best to write a whole book with no lawyers, and I got to the very end, and I had to have a couple.
you mentioned a little while ago, you were talking about social justice and the death penalty and some of the issues that you've taken on. I know one thing that you've been involved with for a long time is the Innocence Project, which is an organization dedicated to exonerating people who have been wrongfully convicted. What is your sense of how much progress we are or aren't making on this issue?
We're making progress in that we are getting innocent people out of prison. It's very difficult to do. It's easier to send an innocent person to prison than it is to get them out. There have been something like 2,000 exonerations in the last 25 years. That's the tip of the iceberg for the number of innocent people who are in prison. The real progress is being made on the policy side. We're convincing more and more states to adopt laws that prevent wrongful convictions, and we have a whole package of legislative proposals that we give every state, and we would love for every state to pass these. And if you could pass these eight pieces of legislation, you could prevent almost all wrongful convictions, and that's our position. So yeah, we're making progress, and I think because of there have been so many high profile exonerations, you know, North Carolina's had their share. Everybody has them now. I think juries are more skeptical, and you're seeing fewer death verdicts, and so fewer executions.
You a related topic to that is all of the difficulty between police departments and minorities. In Charlotte, we had riots and protests last year after the shooting, fatal police shooting of an African-American man here. I'm wondering, you could do seven shows on this, but just generally, what is your thought on trying to restore some level of trust between law enforcement and minority communities?
I don't know where you begin. I just don't know. And you know, these shootings have been happening for a long time, but now we have so many cameras. When you catch them, when you see them on tape, it's hard to believe. And I saw the Charlotte thing last year. We happened to be in Chapel Hill when it happened, and you know, it's just hard to believe that that could not have ended differently than someone losing their life. And that's the case with a lot of these shootings. But it's got to be better dialogue, better training. I don't know. I don't know where to begin. I've struggled with it. I have not been tempted to write about it because it's such an emotional issue right now, and I can't figure it out. I don't know how we solve that problem. The police are under enormous pressure because there are so many guns out there. There are so many people out there who are jacked up on drugs and carrying guns. I mean, we lose cops every day. I mean, they're under enormous pressure, and you have to understand that.
Obviously, your books are entertainment, but when you're tackling people on death row and issues like that, I mean, there is some unsettling emotional content there. I'm wondering if Camino Island, in a way, was just like a day at the park, because really, not many people are getting hurt in a serious way when you're dealing with a manuscript.
What do we have, two dead bodies, I think?
Yeah, I thought the count was really low.
Well, yeah, we didn't kill off many.
I didn't know if you were softening in your old age or what was going on.
Well, you got to have, even with sort of a mystery like Camino Island, you got to have some suspense.
Sure.
There's got to be an element of danger. You got to have bad guys, and I've said this for 25 years, one key to popular fiction, if you're writing suspense or mystery, you've got to have really great bad guys. You've got to have some people who are believable who can do some damage. And they've got to be lurking out there. And there's a little bit of that in Camino Island. But, it was a pure romp. It was fun to write. And, it was a day at the beach.
Literally. You often describe yourself as lazy, yet, as we've mentioned a few times, you've written 30 novels. You've had 25 straight years with the legal thriller. So what keeps you so prolific? Because I know it's not the money at this point.
I have not worked 40 hours a week in probably 27 years. The hours aren't there. I write 3 or 4 hours each morning, 5 days a week for most of the year. And then after you write for 3 or 4 hours, your brain's pretty well mush anyway. Mm-hmm. So I do something physical and tend to the business side of it for an hour or two and then go play golf or something. Used to have coached Little League Baseball, but the kids are all grown now. So I took up golf, and that's a mistake when you're 50 years old.
How's that going? I think you just answered
ugly.
It.
It's so ugly. I'm not a serious golfer. I'm a fun golfer, mm-hmm. and we have a good time doing it. When the books come out, there's a fair amount of promotion. But again, it's not. This is not hard work. There are moments when you're facing the deadline. I'm facing the deadline, and things aren't going well, mm-hmm. And you got to go back and fix stuff. And there's some. It can be hairy moments. I don't think about the pressure. I mean, I know when I publish a book, it's going to be read by a lot of people, a lot of faithful, loyal readers. I'm thankful for that, but I can't think about them when I'm writing the book. My goal when I start a book is to make this the best book I've ever written, and that's really the way I start, or the most entertaining, and that's all I can think about for 6 months.
You're listening to the voice of John Grisham, the best-selling author who is in Charlotte as part of his book tour. I'm wondering, when you have a career like yours where you've been so successful, every book goes right on the bestseller list, how do you avoid complacency or just thinking to yourself, you know what, whatever I write, they're going to buy it, so.
I have not been there yet because I'm always intrigued by the next story, the next issue, the next case, the next law firm explosion, whatever the story is. There's so many good stories, and I want to write all of them. I wrote one book called The Innocent Man, one book of nonfiction. And we were talking about Innocence Project cases a while ago. I would love to write every Innocence story because they're fascinating cases because of the suffering and the mistakes and the tragedy and, men spending 30 years in prison for somebody else's rape. And you prove it now with DNA. And those are fascinating stories to me. I'm not going to do it. I don't have enough time to write all of them. But that still keeps me awake at night. So that's how some of these issues do. And that's how I that's why I get up in the morning and I want to write about it.
You practiced law in Mississippi for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You've made it pretty clear over the years that you don't seem to long to return to that career. Would that still be the case for you? No pun intended.
I have said many times I will never again voluntarily enter a courtroom. If I get dragged into court, I guess I'll go. But I don't want to be a lawyer again.
I'm always fascinated by work habits of writers and reading about yours. They're simple, but they are, I think, incredibly important given the age we live in now, which is that I believe you go into a quiet space where you don't have internet and one of these things mm-hmm. driving you crazy. Is that right?
No phones, no faxes, no internet. It's a little office behind the main house. It's a quiet little place. And it's dark, and it's I sit there look at the screen with the computer, and the hours from 7 to 10 are really special. I mean, I love being there. I love waking up in the morning and going over to the office with a strong cup of coffee and just being able to write and create and for several hours. It's a very simple work style.
In this interview, and also I think in plenty of others, in some of your introductions to your books, Renee Grisham, your wife, seems to play a very large role in your work life. Tell us a little bit about why she has been and how she's been so influential.
Well, I don't start a book until she likes the idea. And I may run 3 or 4 ideas by her. I may get an idea today for a book next year and say, what about this idea? Do you like this? And we spend time kicking those around, and she is brutally honest, and always has been. That's always been the deal. You know, you can say anything. You're not going to hurt my feelings. And then once I start writing, she'll read about half the book when I get there to see how it's going, and then toward the end, she'll read three or four chapters at a time to. You know, not really as an editor, but as a reader who has a real good sense of story and pacing. And occasionally she'll say something like, the story is really dragging here. This is going nowhere. This little scene you wrote here doesn't add much. And so I'll think about that and I'll go back and fix it. Now, that's the process.
And so you don't argue?
We argue like crazy. When the kids were when the kids were small, we'd be having a serious literary discussion about the fiction, you know, and raise our voices in the kitchen, and you know, back and forth and back. And the kids would run in the kitchen, hoping to see a good fight, and they would realize it's mom and dad arguing over the books again. You know, kids were so disappointed because there was never a real good fight.
So we'll close the chapter on the Grisham marriage there. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from John Grisham, who's in Charlotte. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and I am joined by John Grisham today, who is here as part of his book tour. He has a new novel, Camino Island. It is his 30th, and it is almost lawyer-free. It's as close as he could get, I think. We were talking a little bit about your process of grading and judging book ideas and the progress of a book. I'm wondering whether there's an idea out there that your wife has pushed you to pursue that you just haven't gotten to yet.
Yes, a couple. We still talk about them. A couple of really good ideas that need some time to fester and foment and grow and be discussed. So I'm not going to tell you what they are because they may never happen.
Mm-hmm.
But no, she's. If she has an idea, especially with in the legal setting, she's gonna polish it up and run it by me.
Mm-hmm. We had one of your fellow Mississippi writers, Greg Isles, in here a couple months ago, and he spoke a little bit about the work that you were involved in with him in terms of the Confederate flag in Mississippi. Wondering, in your books, you try to stay out of political matters, but how involved do you get in your personal life with issues like that?
Well, Greg did most of the work for that. We tried to get a number of Mississippians to sign a letter asking the state legislature excuse me, to redo the state flag, and because it's the last state to retain the Confederate battle flag as part of the state flag. And it was a process we went through. We had a lot of athletes, a lot of people all over the state. And again, Greg did most of the work. Greg wrote most of the letter, and he and I both solicited people we knew and ended up with an impressive group of people. Didn't do any good. Legislatures, you know, didn't even read it. Excuse me, I'm coughing. I ran for the legislature in 1983 when I was 28 years old and got elected, which ought to be against the law in any state to be elected when you're 28. But I served two terms in the state house and have always followed politics, never had any desire to go to the next level, have not encouraged my kids to get involved in politics. But we do talk a lot about politics, and we do contribute to people we like, and we do that every year.
You've written about the Supreme Court, obviously, in some of your earlier work, and obviously a lot of these stories are set in courtrooms, but the Supreme Court in particular. I'm wondering, when you see the very unusual, heated environment that we're in right now, not only with some of the things in the Supreme Court, but obviously in the White House, does that make you want to go back into that area in terms of your fiction?
It makes me want to move to New Zealand. Yeah, you know, just that was my. You know, it's ridiculous. It's been gridlock for a long time. Now it's nothing but gridlock, and who knows how it's gonna, what's gonna happen? What's the end game here? No one knows. It's ridiculous.
But you do not find it inspiring in terms of stories.
You know, for many years, I've said to myself, I'd love to write a big, thick political novel set in Washington and include all the good guys and the bad guys and all the competing interests, and you know, but it's just too big. I have not been able to, get that story refined in a form that I can make a novel out of it. I'm still trying because I do like politics, and Washington does fascinate me. The book I just finished, the legal thriller that comes out in October, is set in Washington.
Okay.
So it's all about Washington, D.C. So, yeah, you know, one of these days.
Let's hear a little bit. I'm hoping you'll read a little bit from Camino Island. The excerpt that I chose involves a dinner party on this island, and it's a bit of a literary intervention for your main character, Mercer, who has been struggling, and I'll let you pick it up from there if there's any further setup needed.
Well, what happened, the bookstore had a signing, and the signings always draw a big crowd at this bookstore. There's a lot of loyal fans. There's a little literary mafia that hangs out around the bookstore and Bruce Cable, our bookseller. And so afterwards, they often have dinner back at Bruce's house with several writers, the visiting writer, and then three or four local writers, whoever's in town, they come over for a long dinner. And in this case, the visiting writer signed at the store and didn't feel well, so he went back to the hotel. So we're at Bruce's house with Bruce's wife. And there's two writers in particular, Myra, who's a big, large woman who made a bunch of money writing trashy romance novels. I mean, really trashy stuff. And her partner is Lee, and they wrote these novels together over a 20-year career. And they're very colorful, especially Myra. And so they're ready to kind of pounce on Mercer, our heroine, because she's been there now for a few weeks. They really like her. She's a likable person. But they're kind of tired of her talking about writer's block, okay?
Right.
She's just not writing anything. And so Myra decides it's time for a literary intervention. And this is how it goes. They passed around a large serving bowl of shrimp risotto and a basket of bread, and after a few bites, Myra began looking for trouble. She said, "Here's what I think we should do, if I might say so," she said, chomping away with a mouthful of food. "This is very unusual, and I've never done it before, which is all the more reason to do it now, you know, venture into unknown territory. We should have a literary intervention right now around this table. Mercer, you've been here for, what, a month or so, and haven't written a damn word that might one day be sold, and frankly, I'm getting kind of tired of your moaning and bellyaching about not making any progress with the novel. So it's pretty obvious to all of us that you don't have a story, and since you haven't been published in, what, 10 years? More like 5, Mercer says. Whatever. It's plain as day you need some help. So what I propose is that we intervene as your new friends and help you find a story. Just look at all the talent around the table here. Surely we can steer you in the right direction." Mercer said, "Well, it can't get any worse." "See what I mean?" Myra said. "So we're here to help." She gulped some more beer from a bottle and said, "Now, for purposes of this intervention, we need to set some parameters. First and most important is to decide whether you want to write literary fiction, stuff you can't give away. Hell, Bruce can't even sell it. Or do you want to write something that might be popular? I've read your novel and your stories, and I'm not the least bit surprised they didn't sell. Forgive me, okay? This is, after all, an intervention. So we have to be brutally blunt, okay? Everybody okay with the bluntness thing?" "Go for it," Mercer said with a smile. The rest nodded. "We're all having fun. Let's hear it." Myra crammed a fork stuffed with lettuce and kept talking. "I mean, you're a beautiful writer, girl, and some of your sentences stop me cold, which one could argue is not something a good sentence is supposed to do. But anyway, you can write like hell, and I think you can write anything. So what's it going to be, literary fiction or popular fiction?" "Can it be both?" Bruce asked, thoroughly enjoying the conversation. "For a handful of authors, right," Myra replied, "but for the vast majority, the answer is no." She looked at Mercer and said, "This is something we've been debating for about 10 years, since the first day we met. But anyway, let's assume that you will probably not be able to write literary fiction that will slay the critics and also rack up impressive royalties. And by the way, there is no envy here. I don't write anymore, so my career is over. I'm not sure what Lee is doing these days, but she's damn sure not publishing anything. Now, Myra, Lee said. So we can safely say her career is over, too, and we don't care. We're old, we have plenty of money, so there's no competition. You're young and gifted, and you'll have a future if you can just figure out what to write. Thus, this intervention. We're just here to help. By the way, this risotto is delicious, Noel. Am I supposed to respond? Mercer asked.
So, very nice. Thank you. That's John Grisham reading from Camino Island. Sounds to me like there might be maybe a little bit of personal experience in there, not in terms of writer's block for you, but parsing out the difference between, are we going to be a popular writer or a literary writer?
It's the old feud, the old argument.
And you clearly, though, you have seemed very comfortable being a commercial writer. It doesn't seem to bother you too much if literary snobs say, I'm not reading that, or maybe you just don't pay attention to them. How do you handle that?
Don't pay attention. And when it, in the early days, it was kind of painful to get roughed up by the critics because that's what they do with popular authors. And so it's never fun. But I also learned early on, just don't read the reviews. And I avoid almost all the reviews, good or bad.
Good or bad.
Yeah, I don't want to
stay
hear
away.
It. Yeah,
yeah. So what do you think when you see something like, I know you and Stephen King have been friends for many years. He was dismissed, still is by some, but he was dismissed for a long time as a popular author. And then finally, he was given a National Book Award. And so he began to get a little more critical acclaim, and all of a sudden people were saying, oh, this guy's not such a bad writer. Do you hold out that kind of hope? Do you worry about that kind of thing in terms of legacy?
Do not worry about that one bit. I don't even think about it. I don't care about a legacy. I'm not going to write a biography. When I'm dead, I'm dead. You know, if the books keep selling, great. My estate will be happy. My kids will be happy. If not, I'm not going to worry about that either.
I think I mentioned earlier that you and your wife bought a condo or a place in Chapel Hill within the last 10 years or so. What do you? How much time do you get to spend in Chapel Hill, and how are you treated up there?
Well, she bought the condo in 2008 when she came back to school, and that's where she lived when she was a student. She came home almost every weekend. And that was our daughter enrolled here in 2004, and so Renee has been looking for an old house in the historic section for a long time. And so we bought one a year ago on Franklin Street.
You did.
And we're getting rid of the condo. So we now have an old house that we're doing some work with. We're always treated nice in Chapel Hill. Very, very nice people. And the university is great, and we love hanging out there.
Well, while I've got you spending money, I'm wondering, given the topic of Camino Island, Ann Patchett and Larry McMurtry, among others, have bought or opened bookstores. Did you ever give any thought to doing that?
Never. No. I can't see me. We talked about it once, not seriously, about, you know, partnering with somebody else to kind of save a bookstore. And I told Renee, yeah, and here's what will happen. The partnership will blow up, and I'll be at the cash register on Sunday afternoon, selling copies of Harry Potter in paperback when I could be doing. You know, that's what will happen. I'll get stuck with it and have to work, and I'm not going to work a cash register. So I love bookstores, but it's retail. It's a tough way to make a buck, and it's 27 days a week, so not me.
So if you want to see John Grisham at a bookstore, I hope you were at Park Road Books in Charlotte on Wednesday, or that you pick up another one of his stops the rest of this month, because he is not going to work the register. You learned it here first. John Grisham, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
This is Eric Spanberg. I've been in for Mike Collins, and thanks for listening to us today on Charlotte Talks.